This is a session entitled Sharing Christmas Memories, and it's a chance for all of you to share and hear Christmas stories from one another. Tonight we've asked Mary Schramm to start it off with telling a couple stories, and then I'll open it up to all the rest of you. We do ask that you come up here to tell your story so that it can be clearly interpreted, and that way everyone will be able to understand and be a part of our discussion tonight. And then we'll go till about 7:15. So, Mary Schramm.
Before I do the first story, I was reminded of this poem by Shel Silverstein at dinner tonight as we ate. It doesn't have a lot to do with Christmas, but it has the word in it. Thanksgiving dinners, sad and thankless. Christmas dinners, dark and blue, when we stop and look at dinner from the turkey's point of view. Sunday dinner isn't sunny. Easter feasts are just bad luck when you see it from the viewpoint of a chicken or a duck. Oh, how I once loved tuna salad, pork and lobster, lamb chops too, till I stopped and looked at dinner from the dinner's point of view. This next story is, at first, I wasn't sure how Christmassy it was, but it comes from a book by Ted Loader called Tracks in the Straw. And he tells stories of Christmas from all of the different characters in the creche scene, from the donkey and the dove and all of the people that we think about in our Christmas stories. This one is called Clumsy, Beautiful. I like it because, to me, Christmas is probably summarized in the verse that Jesus came to bring us life, and life abundantly. So this is Clumsy, Beautiful by Ted Loader. Oh, they're always yelling at me in this place. Seems like the busier it gets, the more they yell. When it gets this busy, the innkeeper's fit to be tied. He probably ought to be. I mean, he's afraid we're going to make a mistake and some customer's going to get mad and he's going to lose a few denarii. So the busier it gets, the more he yells. Oh, he yells kind of quiet like a snake hissing. But don't make no matter, it's yelling just the same. Deborah! That's my name, and the prettiest thing about me, I've been told, is if I ought to have an ugly name. Deborah! Bring in the wine. Bring the goblets. Fetch some more wood. Sweep the floor. Wipe up the vomit. On and on he goes. He yells things at me, too, that I wouldn't dare tell you. I just try to ignore him and go about my business. Oh, there's one thing they do call me, though. And that's clumsy. I guess I am. I'm always spilling wine and dropping the cups and tripping over the door sill and ripping my skirt. And people laugh at me a lot. Customers especially, they say really crude things to me. Oh, I don't know. I guess they got a right to do that, but I don't know why my body won't do what I want it to do. It's just a source of embarrassment. And if the truth be told, I'm clumsy with words, too. When anybody says something to me and I'm supposed to answer, my throat gets all tight and my mouth gets dry and I just go blank. It's the same way when I try to talk to the other servants. Oh, now, I don't want you to get me wrong, thinking I'm innocent or naive or anything like that. Oh, I can tell as bawdy a story as the next person and hold my own in an argument. But when it comes to them pretty words, they're just as hard for me to get as trying to catch that white dove out in the back of the inn. Oh, still, I guess it don't matter me being clumsy, since I'm just a servant and a woman. Although, this is kind of what I want to tell you about, and I don't have the words to say it very well, but I think maybe if you'd understand me a little bit more, then maybe I could understand myself. Oh, there's another thing. I'm plain. I mean, real plain, as you can see. I don't know why I keep mentioning these things, but they say that how a person feels about herself helps other people to know her and what she's trying to say. Oh, men still pinch me and pat me and try to feel me when I walk by. Sometimes they ask me to do things with them, saying things they don't mean. Oh, to be perfectly frank, once in a while I do go with them, just for the attention for a few moments. And I guess if I'm going to be honest, I'd have to say I kind of like how it feels when we're doing what we're doing when we're doing it. But men don't mean nothing permanent by me. Oh, I guess I'm not much worse off than a lot of women what gets taken for wives. Just a little less secure, maybe. Well, anyway, to get on with my story, the whole week has just been crazy in this town. I mean, it's been brimming to overflowing in this inn all night long. And it ain't very glamorous being a servant girl in an inn like this, in a town like this, on a night like this. I mean, you get to feel like a bear of, well, like a beast of burden. I just carry wood and wine and water. And all night long, I mean, it's been so noisy and people have been yelling at me and I was just in a fog. And I got this splitting headache, and I bet I've been up and down them stairs 100, 200, 400 times at least. And not long ago, I tripped over somebody's feet, and I just burst out crying. Oh, I was so embarrassed that I went in the closet and just stayed there for a while. It's still the middle of the night, and things is going strong. Deborah, you mangy goat, go fetch some more wood. Well, I was kind of glad for the opportunity to go outside because I thought maybe I could rest for a little bit. So I pushed my way through the kitchen and I grabbed a crust of bread and slapped Nathan's hand when he tried to get fresh. Then I went into the backyard. I leaned against the wall for a moment. A bear of wood and wine and water and whatever else it is men wants. And I started gulping my bread and going back to the woodshed, all of a sudden, I slipped in the mud. I mean, I went in the mud up over my hips. And I just lay back in that mud and I started crying for all I was worth, mostly from tiredness and frustration than from any hurt. I just lay in the mud crying and I looked up and all of a sudden, I sat up and started laughing. I don't know why, but it came to me what I want to tell you. What came to me was how quiet it was. I mean, there was the moon up there all bright and shiny, and the clouds touching its face was all gentle, like I imagined the lovers would be. And the stars. I mean, they was like candles that somebody just lit up, and the darkness around each one just shattered like black lace and fell to the ground like black snow. And the cold and the mud and the light was all quivering like when you had your first kiss and don't know what's coming next. Oh, I never realized how sweet bread tastes on your tongue before it goes down to calm your growling belly. It was as if I had waked life up, like it had been just lying there unnoticed up till now. And then I heard this baby cry. Oh, you hear babies cry a lot in the night, and they're mostly just aggravated because they wake you up. But this time, I was curious. And so I followed the sound out to the stable where old Napfully works. And there, well, I don't know how I can even tell you about this. But there was this family and this young mother and this baby. I mean, this baby was like oh, how do you say it, a miracle. I mean, it was alive, and it was kicking, and all of its parts was moving, and it was cooing and making funny sounds. I mean, how does this happen? How does this happen? Oh, I wish I had the words to tell you. But what I can tell you is that right then and ever since, I have felt strangely beautiful and proud. Serious proud to be a woman and to be someone who could produce a miracle like this, or receive a miracle like this, or be a miracle like this, sort of. Ah, I don't have the words, but I know I also felt strangely graceful. Graceful about me and about life, and even about that old innkeeper. Oh, I mean, imagine to be so close, so much a part of God's creation. Oh, I wish I had the words to tell you. I hope you know, though, how beautiful it is that God makes babies and people, even though they're plain like me and got mud all over them. Oh, I hope you got the words or the quietness.
This last one you know, but it's one of my favorites. Once upon a time, or many years ago, as time was calculated by men, but which was only yesterday in the celestial calendar of heaven, there was in paradise a most miserable, thoroughly unhappy, and utterly dejected cherub who was known throughout heaven as the littlest angel. He was exactly 3 years, 6 months, 7 days, 9 hours, 42 minutes, and 53 seconds old when he presented his small self before the venerable gatekeeper and waited admittance to the glorious kingdom of God. Standing defiantly with his bare brown legs spread wide apart, he tried to pretend that he wasn't at all afraid and not at all impressed by such unearthly splendor. But his lower lip trembled, and a tear disgraced him by making a new furrow down his already tear-streaked face and coming to a precipitous end at the very tip of his tiny freckled nose. And the littlest angel, having left home as usual without a handkerchief, endeavored to hide the telltale evidence by sniffing, oh, a most unangelic sound, which so unnerved the good gatekeeper that he did something he had never done before in all eternity. He blotted the page. Well, from that time on, the heavenly peace was never quite the same, and the littlest angel soon became the despair of all the heavenly host. His shrill, ear-splitting whistle could be heard at all hours through the golden streets. It startled the patriarch fathers and disturbed their meditation. Oh, and he was always arriving late for nightly prayers, knocking everyone's wings askew as he darted into place. And it was first whispered among the cherubims and seraphims, and then said aloud among the angels and the archangels, that he didn't even look like an angel. And they were correct. He didn't. His halo was permanently tarnished where he'd held onto it with one hot, chubby hand while running. And he was always running. And even when he was standing still, it never behaved like a halo should. It would either slip over the left eye or slip over the right eye, or else just for pure meanness, slipping off the back of his head and rolling down some golden street just so he'd have to chase after it. It was also reported and never denied that when he was nervous, which was most of the time, he bit his wingtips. Well, anyone can see that sooner or late, the littlest angel would have to be disciplined. So on an eternal day of an eternal month and year eternal, the littlest angel was directed to present his small self before the angel of the peace. He tried to postpone the dreaded ordeal as long as possible by loitering along the street of the guardian angel and carefully examining a new display of harps, although everyone knew he didn't know a semiquaver from a guitar. and pausing a few more endless minutes to carefully look over a long list of new arrivals that had come up on the bus that day, although everyone in the heavenly kingdom knew he couldn't read a word. But at length and at last, he approached a door surmounted by two golden scales, signifying that heavenly justice was being dispensed within. The littlest angel took off his halo, breathed on it heavily, polished it upon the sleeve of his almost clean gown, and then quietly tiptoed in. To the great surprise of the littlest angel, he heard someone singing. The singer, who was known as the Understanding Angel, looked down at the small culprit, who immediately tried to make himself invisible by the ingenious process of pulling his head down into the collar of his robe, very much like a snapping turtle. At that, the Understanding Angel laughed, a jolly, heartwarming laugh, and he said, "Oh, yes, you're the one that's been making heaven so unheavenly. Come here, cherub, and tell me all about it." And almost before he knew it, he was perched on the lap of the Understanding Angel, just trying to explain how difficult it was for a boy who suddenly found himself transformed into an angel. Oh, not that heaven wasn't beautiful, but wasn't earth beautiful too? There were hills to climb and caves to play at pirate chief, and there was the sun coming up and the sand so warm and soft beneath your feet. The Understanding Angel smiled, and in his eyes was a long-forgotten memory of another small boy many years ago. And then he said to the littlest angel, "What would make you most happy in paradise?" The littlest angel thought for a moment, and then he said, "Oh, I know. There's a box. Oh, I left it under my bed back home. If only I could have that box." "You shall have it," promised the Understanding Angel. And a fleet-winged heavenly messenger was instantly dispatched to bring the box to paradise. Now, in all those timeless days that followed, everyone remarked at the wonderful change in the littlest angel. For among all the cherubs in God's kingdom, he was the most heavenly. His conduct was above the slightest reproach, and his appearance was all that the most fastidious could wish for. Yes, and on excursions to Elysian fields, it could be said, and truly said, that he flew like an angel. Then it came to pass that Jesus, the Son of God, was to be born of Mary in Bethlehem of Judea. And all the angels put aside their gifts or their tasks to prepare their gifts for the blessed infant. Everyone, that is, except the littlest angel. He sat himself down on the very top of the golden stairs and anxiously waited for inspiration. Oh, what could he give that would be acceptable to the Son of God? "Oh, I know," he said. "I will compose a prayer that will live forever in the hearts of humankind, because it will be the first prayer ever to be heard by the baby Jesus. Dear God, amen." He was woefully lacking in literary ability. And then he said, "Oh no, I'll write a song and I'll get the angels to sing it. It'll be a wonderful song to welcome the baby Jesus." But he never got fast past the first hallelujah, and that was about it. Well, the day of the miracle finally arrived, when the littlest angel finally decided on his gift. And he took it from its hiding place behind a cloud. It was a rough, unhewn wooden box, but inside were all those wonderful things that even the child of God would cherish. And he took his little gift and he put it down among the gifts of all the other angels. Gifts of such radiant splendor and glorious beauty that all heaven and the universe were lighted by the mere reflection of their glory. And the littlest angel realized that what he had done was sacrilegious. It was blasphemy. Oh, why had he ever thought that such a dumb gift would be acceptable for the Christ child? And he devoutly wished that he could reclaim it. But it was too late. The hand of God moved slowly over all the bright array of shining gifts and paused and dropped and came to rest on the lonely gift of the littlest angel. And there before all the eyes of the heavenly host was what he had offered to the Christ child. In the bottom of the box, there were two little blue robin's eggs, one slightly cracked. And there was a butterfly that he had captured one bright sunny day outside his mother's house in the hills of Jerusalem. And there were two round white stones that he had gathered along the river's edge. And in the very bottom of the box was a tooth-marked leather strap, once worn by his mongrel dog who had died as he had lived in absolute love and infinite devotion. The littlest angel wept hot, bitter tears, and he turned to run and hide from the divine wrath of God, but he stumbled and fell, and with a horrified wail and a clatter of halo, he rolled to the very foot of the throne of God. And then God's voice rose like thunder throughout heaven, and God said, "Of all the gifts of all the angels, I find that this gift pleases me most, for its contents are of heaven and of earth, and my son is born to be king of both. I accept this gift in the name of the Christ child, who will be born this night of Mary in Bethlehem of Judea." And all of a sudden, the littlest angel's box began to glow. And the glow became a brilliant light, and none but the littlest angel saw it rise from its resting place in heaven and go to arch the firmament. Earthly eyes, too, blinded by its brilliance, would never know that the lowly gift of the littlest angel was what all people would forever call the shining star of Bethlehem.
Well, I suppose I can tell an Advent story. Okay, go ahead, Mary.
No,
do you have another one?
I'm just going to give an incident. No, I'm just going to give an incident. Well,
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
When we lived on the farm in West Virginia, we were snowbound one Christmas, and we didn't have enough wood. We didn't know how much wood our two wood burning stoves would take. And it was, well, we didn't think we were going to freeze to death, but it made us very, very nervous because we didn't have any kind of vehicle that could get out of our mile and a quarter lane past the stream and out into the gravel road. And we looked out the window on Christmas Eve afternoon, and there came our neighbor Theodore with a whole truckload of wood. And he had a four-wheel drive truck with a plow in the front. He came up and he said, "You city folks, I just didn't think you were going to have, I knew you weren't going to have enough wood because I saw how much you had cut." And he said, "I thought maybe you could use some wood." And honestly, if that's what Santa Claus is like, reindeer with a bunch of gifts, I think that was the most wonderful Christmas present we ever had.
All right, I'll tell an Advent story from the fourth Sunday of Advent. When I was an intern pastor in Hutchinson, Minnesota, this must have been in 1980 or 1979, and we had a custom in our congregation, many of you probably have this in yours also, where a different family came up and lit the Advent candles each week, and then like someone in the family read a Bible verse and somebody else read a prayer, and then they'd all kind of traipse back. And we had this kind of elaborate Advent wreath that was a big kind of cast iron wreath like this with four slots for candles. It was large, maybe as large as this circle here. And then it was it hung from the ceiling on this kind of pulley system deal so that there was probably, well, about this high. There was maybe 20 feet of chain going up the ceiling, and then it went through a loop there and then came back and attached over about here on a hook on the wall. And So this was the fourth Sunday of Advent. So it was, I think it was the Berglund family. Yes, I can see them now. Mr. Berglund, who was the superintendent of schools, and Mrs. Berglund, and then three really cute kids. They all had, I think the little girls had these red velvet dresses on, and the little boy had on a really cute little suit. Anyway, they were all dressed up to light the Advent candles. And so Mr. Berglund unhooked the Advent wreath here and let it down from up there, let it down, and then each of the kids lit a candle. And then he hoisted it back up and attached it over here, so he thought, anyway. And and then Mrs. Berglund read a scripture passage, and then Mr. Berglund was in the middle of a prayer. And all of a sudden, I'll never forget it, this horrible crash came, and the Advent wreath came down, just plunging down from the ceiling, candles flying off in every direction. There were four lit candles, and what was so funny about it was that you could tell he was in the middle of this prayer, and he was trying to decide whether to acknowledge that anything had happened or not. You know that feeling when you're praying that really nothing should interrupt you. You know, if a child cries, you just go on. If anything happens, you just sort of continue. But this was like a horrible scene with these kids crying. I mean, none of them had gotten hit by the wreath or the candles, fortunately, but anyway, it's really funny. And you could just see him pausing to decide whether to go on or acknowledge that the Advent wreath had just crashed to the floor. And finally, he did stop and said, like, oops, or something like that. And then went on. Anyway, that's one of my vivid and favorite Advent memories, because it was just so, you know, it was when the interruption is more memorable than the event itself. I guess he finally got it hoisted back up, and the candles all lit, and the children calmed down and went on with the prayer. But anyway, it was a fulfillment of that prayer, stir up our hearts, O Lord. Prepare for your son here.
Was that Dale and Deborah Berglund?
Yes.
Do you know him? Deborah Berglund was the intern pastor at my church last year.
Okay, well, you see, it was a moving experience, and she ended up going to seminary. And their kids are probably grown up now, but yeah, that was them. Uh-huh. Linda, are you?
It's a definite change of pace.
Well, this is a story song, and it's been one of my favorites for a while. It was written by a man named John Pohl, and I learned it from the singing of Frankie Armstrong. It's called Anti-Carol. It takes me a minute to get the pitch. It weren't no picnic. It weren't no picture postcard. It was cold as taters in the morn when the couple come looking for a room. That's not the right bitch, no. It weren't no picnic. It weren't no picture postcard. It was cold as taters in the morn when the couple come looking for a room. Cold-shouldered they were when the landlord looked at her and saw the baby in her womb. Cold comfort they got was there a room there was not. The town was crowded for a start. And it was cold, 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 cold as a beggar boy's heart. It could have been in Joburg, just concrete and iron and a blanket to lie on. They'd been walking all day. And their home was such a long, 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 long way away. They never heard no angels, just the Oakley siren. When the light come fumbling through the night, her water broke and the kid began to come. Is there a doctor up here? Only poor people here. What would you pay them with, chum? There was ice on the door. She sweated, he swore. He saw the head of his child. Then together, him and her helped it into the world. There weren't no cattle watching, just a rat and 20 cockroach. The kid cried, his dad soon had him washed and dried, and when his mother woke, she gave him the breast. He shared his parents' love, and he was heir to their poverty. 'Twas all that was theirs. And then the rumor got round that there were soldiers in town with orders search and destroy. They didn't want to get wasted, they left town a bit hasty. The man, his wife, and their boy, 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 boy. Young wife and new baby boy. He was theirs, they made him. Out of love, hope, and suffering. God's son, or just another one, more like millions born to slaves come and die. Perhaps when he grows and sees how the world goes, he'll help to change it by and by. Let's hope the soldiers don't hang this new son of man like they did once before. Will he bring peace or a gun whenever his kingdom does come? It will belong to the poor, 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 the homeless and poor.
Lester, I hear that you have a story.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm going to tell you is true. It happened about 42 years ago.
New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
Along
the coast of New Jersey. And there was a small church and a young man who had just been called to be a pastor in the Lutheran Church of New Jersey. And it was near Christmas time. And maybe about 6 or 7 weeks before Christmas. In the year 1948. He was called to a small church, and the church itself was pretty run down. It needed a lot of work. And it was a small congregation. And he arrived, and he was looking around the church, and the walls needed painting badly. And the floor and the carpets were just ruined. And the pews needed painting. And it was getting nearer and nearer to Christmas time. He knew that he had to arrange some Christmas program for the church. But the church needed so much to be done, and there was such a short time left. So he and his wife decided to roll up their sleeves and get to work. And so they started painting, and they painted the whole church, painting and painting. They painted all of the pews. And fixing everything, and fixing it all around. And the church started to have a new life again. Just like it had such a long time ago. And there was excitement in the church, because he knew, you know how people are, they were getting excited. Boy, what a good job has been done. And that actually happened. And then 3 days before Christmas, a hurricane hit this little church in from the New Jersey coast. And the church got a tremendous amount of water damage. The structure could not, and the roof couldn't handle the water and just collapsed down. And you know what the wife and the pastor did with all this damage?
when the pastor came in and he looked around the church with all that damage, and he said, oh, all that work done for nothing. 3 more days until Christmas. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so they decided they'd just do the best that they could and try to fix everything up again and do the best they can, get rid of all the water, clean it all up. Of course, it wasn't going to be perfect, but it was better, the best that they could do. And they actually did a pretty good job, except for one thing.
The wall.
The one wall. The wall behind the altar.
The pastor.
Decided to take the whole wall down.
Okay,
there was no way I could fix that. It was just a mess. He saw it, and it looked so bad. All the rest would look pretty good, but that one wall, it was just a disaster. So that one wall, it was just a few more hours before church started. He decided there was an auction near the church. And the pastor went over to the auction and looked around and looked around and found just a beautiful lace piece. A beautiful lace tablecloth. Just a gorgeous tablecloth. And he bought it for $70. $750. Bought it at a sale. Not a nice one that you'd find at the store. It was just like a nice one you'd find in a store. From a foreign country. He saw that beautiful lace thing fly, and he said, that's just right what I need to cover up that ugly wall. So he bought it, brought it home. And the pastor went to church, and over there in the corner, at the bus stop, he saw an old lady standing waiting for the bus. And she kept looking at her watch, and she knew it would be half an hour before the bus would arrive. And outside it was very cold. So he said, well, come here. Come on into church. Sit down and rest. And wait for the bus. You have time. Come in and rest. Come into church and rest. And they got to talking about... And she said, I'm from the old country.
Austria.
I'm from Austria. And I haven't been here very long. And I've been looking for work. This morning, I went across town, and I tried to get some money from the bank. I tried to have them to give me some work, and there's just nothing to do. So I come home. I decided to leave soon, and I was just sitting there watching. So the pastor opened the package and put that big lace up on the wall. And quickly, the lady said,
I had a cloth
just like that so many years ago. It looked just the same as that.
She wanted it.
And she wanted it. And he offered to give it to her. But she said, no, you better leave it up on the wall. You better leave it there. She said, but boy, that's beautiful. I had one just like that before the war. And they looked at time, and it was time for her to leave, and so she left. And that night... It was Christmas Eve.
People
flocked to the church.
Church was full.
And the church was full. And the Christmas songs and the service was beautiful. And the church looked just as good as it did many years ago. It was a beautiful night. And after the church service was over, there was one old man that stayed seated in the church. He was in the very last pew. He was an old man who looked very tired. And the pastor came over and said, are you feeling all right? And he said, yes, I feel all right, yes. But I'm just admiring that beautiful lace piece up in the front. And he thought to himself, it looks just exactly like a cloth that I had lost before the war. When I left Austria to meet my wife, the Germans had taught him everything that he had lost, and he was in a concentration camp for several years, a prisoner, and he was released finally after the war. When he arrived and he looked at that lace, he just kept saying, said, my wife had one exactly like that. It's uncanny how similar that is to the one I had. And the pastor thought quickly, you know, this morning there was an old lady in the church that said the exact same thing that you did, the exact same thing. And the pastor thought to himself, could that be? Could that be my wife? Could that be? And he started asking the pastor what questions, and he said, that must be a connection. There must be a connection. And so he said, describe the old woman. And he said, I think that's my long lost wife. But he had never known where his wife had went. But he had remembered the lady had told him this morning that I was working for a man across town. So the pastor remembered the name of the man, and they telephoned him, and they asked for the address. And the man remembered that lady, yes, she was here this morning, and he remembered the address and quickly gave it to the man. And so the pastor quickly put on his clothes and took the man, got in his car, and drove as quickly as they could through windy roads of town and found the correct address. Well, they walked and walked, and they wondered if the woman was still there or had left. Maybe she had gone. They didn't know. But they arrived to the apartment and knocked on the door. No answer. Again, they knocked and knocked and knocked, and again there was no answer. And the man started to become so discouraged and disappointed. Then they started hearing footsteps approaching the door, and the door opened. And the husband and wife saw each other for the first time since 1938. They just could not believe it. They saw each other and just could not believe that they were back together, and they were loving each other and hugging each other and giving thanks to God for the miracle of Christmas Eve. That is a miracle. That proves that their miracles still happen to them.
Sarah, are you coming up here to tell a story?
No.
Okay, who's next?
We had a funny thing happen in children's Christmas pageant one time. We all have the typical Christmas pageant where the older children read the scripture of the Christmas story, and the younger children from ages 1 through about 4 or 5 act up parts in front of the church all dressed up in costumes. We had one little baby that was about 14 months old playing baby Jesus, and he was in the cradle. Mary and Joseph were kneeling there, and his little angel was there. Well, the three wise men came up the aisle, put this box of jewels down right in front of the cradle. So the baby Jesus is watching this little angel. This little angel is about 4 years old. Kept trying to take the jewels out of the box, and the whole time they're reading this story, and this angel's taking him, and baby Jesus slapping him, going,
no, mine.
Well, the whole time, here we are trying to hear this Christmas story with this little baby Jesus slapping the mess out of this little baby angel. It just got to be so funny. And we finally just picked up the jewels so we could finish the story, but it was just so cute how the children just, they don't care.
This Advent story reminded me of one which I'll never live down in our church.
I've got another story.
Okay, let's have you first and then you. Okay, go ahead. You
anyway,
go first. Go ahead.
At our church, we have this metal Advent wreath that sets on the floor. And so one Sunday, why the bishop was there before for this sermon. Well, he gave his sermon both times, both services. But in between, there was a few of us that stayed in there, mostly the pastors and a few of the rest of us that wanted to listen to him. And when he got through, I happened to be on altar duty that day, and I got up to walk over to the see if things were right. And they had put a big piece of plastic under this metal so that it wouldn't get wax on the rug. Well, I hit that. And both feet went out from under me, and I went down and brought my arm over and hit the bottom of that thing and broke it. Or not broke it, but just bruised it. So anyway, of course, here it was, the pastor and the bishop and everybody else over to pick me up. So I will never live that down. They said I didn't have to fall for the bishop.
Here's a short one. In Montana, go up there. Yeah. Oh, it's a short one. Okay, one day, my wife and I had gone to a little town next to 180 miles away. We didn't have a whole lot of money. We filled up the gas tank first and just went over, and we were just going to go over there and come back. And there was a church there in Montana, and I wanted to go to a meeting. There was a deaf congregation there, community. So we decided we would just go ahead and go anyway, just drive over there and see what's going on. And we got close to the town, and my gas tank was getting almost to empty. And there was a man standing there waving, trying to stop us. And so he stopped, and he was in a big Cadillac. And I said, what's wrong? And he said he needed gas. I said, well, me too. So we drove the man to the gas station, and the man filled up the tank. He had 5 gallons. And then he filled up my tank also. So I was holding the book out there.
This is another pageant disaster, but when I was a little girl, my dad's first parish, the church had an aisle that was slanted. I mean, you almost had to lean over when you walked up the aisle. The fire would always puff by the time you got there. But at Christmas, the tradition was that you strung a wire from the end of the balcony and back up to the altar with a star on it that was pulled by some miraculous way from the back of the altar that I could never figure out. Well, Mary and Joseph and the baby are down in front, and we three kings of Oriadar are starting down the aisle. And of course, the star gets halfway down and comes crashing to the aisle. Mary picked up the baby, ran out of the church crying, and had the littlest wise men, and he could never get them back to finish the pageant.
Others?
I don't want to go in front. Can I just
stand here? Yeah, can you stand up?
Well, many years ago, my husband was in the service, and we were stationed in Turkey. Now, Turkey is a Muslim country, and so there are very few Christians, and there certainly was no Christian celebrations to be had in that area. We hadn't been there very long, and our possessions hadn't arrived, and I didn't know what we were going to do for a Christmas tree. We had been told that if you cut a tree in Turkey, you would be jailed until that tree was totally dead. So we certainly weren't going to go out and find a Christmas tree somewhere. We had a closed tree in the hall. The chaplain and his family lived across the street, and they brought over decorations, and we decorated the closed tree. And that was our Christmas tree the first year. The second year, I was again in a quandary, wondering what we would do for a Christmas tree. Christmas Eve, almost miraculously, 3 Christmas trees appeared on our front porch. And I still don't know where they came from.
How about any of you long-term home staff? I was thinking of some of the fun Holden customs. I don't know how many of these you covered this morning, Mary, but some of my favorite memories from Christmas at Holden here are like, I was thinking of, I guess their Advent memories, the Jesse tree, where an ornament is hid under somebody's plate at lunch, and then that person hangs it on a tree, and it's an Old Testament character or Bible verse. And then another one that was really fun was having an Advent angel. We drew names of someone who was then our secret Advent angel throughout Advent and would do nice things for us, and we didn't know who it was, and it was really kind of a wonderful custom. One year, it was things, a lot of times things like back rubs or special treats to eat. One year my Advent angel made a little coffee table for me. That was really wonderful, and I didn't know who it was. You don't find out who it is until pretty late in Advent, and it's really a nice way of gift giving.
We did that in Narnia this week.
You did that in Narnia this week?
Just little gifts, one every day for 5 days.
From a secret Advent angel? Oh, that's great.
Well, people haven't talked much about food disasters, but I know kind of secondhand about a food disaster here in Christmas in July a few years ago. And turkey was going to be the big, the main course. And they had already sliced all the turkey and put it back in the pans, you know, to heat it or keep it warm, I'm not sure which. And it gets pretty stressed in there, if any of you can ever sense some of the hecticness of the kitchen. And the guy who, it was told to me because the cook who was working is also short and I am. And it was told to me at the time that I kind of did a disaster in the kitchen one time. I think it was to make me feel better. But they pulled out the big, it was a large cake pan of the turkey. And this was like about, 15 minutes before the meal was going to be served. And kind of swung the pan around, and if you know where the stoves are in the kitchen, they're not too far from where the three garbage bag or disposable or things are. It includes the plastics and the plastics, burnables, and aluminum or metals, yeah. And just swung around, and the whole pan of turkey just went into the garbage. And this is like, you know, just a few minutes before the meal has to be on the table, and there's not a greater nightmare to have at home. And but fortunately, the really good news about it was that the garbage had been a lot that day, and the garbologist had just come into the kitchen and changed and used brand new bags, which is also probably something that rarely happens at all. Usually recycle all of the garbage bags and rarely put, you know, brand new ones in. But it was a brand new bag, it had never been used, and there was nothing else that had been thrown in the trash can yet. And so they were able to retrieve this turkey out.
This man was perfect. He had a natural white beard and a terrific outfit. And I just stood there shocked, and I kind of jumped back from the door, and I said, who are you? He says, do you have some children? I said, yeah. He says, well, let me see him. And he just burst into the room, and he had a big bag. It was so real. And he knew the names of our children. He said, well, where's Peter? Where's Michael? And I said, well, Peter's upstairs in the bathtub. I said, well, what do you want? He said, well, I have some Christmas goodies for him. And he just burst into the house, and these friends of ours were just aghast, as we all were. We just couldn't figure out what was going on, because we had no idea. He rushes up the stairs. He went through the living room and up the stairs, and I'm behind him, and I said, who are you? I'm going to find out, was this guy the local burglar who's going to be around the next day? In this case, the joint. He says, I'm Santa Claus. Oh, oh, oh. And he played this role so tremendously. He whipped into the bathroom and handed our little kid who was in the bathroom a piece of candy, and he found the other kids and gave them something, and he said, Merry Christmas, and he's off and out the door. Probably in, the whole thing probably took about 40 seconds. And we're all speechless. We just couldn't figure out what it is, and we're standing at the door of these friends, and we all come over to the door. And here's the little girl across the street saying, Mom, it's Santa Claus. It was all so real. It's snowing out there. I see his reindeer, she said. I see his reindeer. We're going, what is this? Well, it was such a wonderful introduction to this neighborhood, and it turns out that this was a local retired doctor who did this every year. He watched during the year for new people that moved into the neighborhood. He did this every year, and it was a wonderful introduction to that neighborhood. And we've enjoyed the neighborhood and the neighbors ever since. But it really made it a special.